Dr. Henry is part of the policy and advisory team for the Church of England. Her work centers mostly on race and equality issues at multiple societal and international levels. And just looking at Dr. Henry's experience, it's so interesting. She's been she was working in the U.S. for 10 years as director of nursing and director of public health. Then she's worked in the UK public sector with the Metropolitan Police, with the London Underground, and with the Crown Prosecution Service, so all these different levels of international and national work. She was the chief executive officer for the Race and Agenda, ROTA, which is a social policy action group that's a charity that's addressing minority concerns. So we're really looking forward to having you speak. And then we have Reverend Martin Cattle, who is also part of the policy advisory team for the Church of England. His role as an advisor focuses on the intersection between prisons, probation, and policing in the criminal justice system. And he's involved in the Church's refugee network and the UK migration, wider UK migration concerns. It's very interesting to read that you've been involved for more than 14 years in the prison service at various levels, so in roles varying from prison officer to senior management in high security prisons. Reverend Kettle has also been an army chaplain and a lecturer in ethics and New Testament at Ridley Hall, Cambridge. So there's a plethora of experience and a wealth of knowledge here. And just join me in welcoming these two of us today.
Thank you. I don't know if we could spend the next half hour qualifying that introduction. we shan't do that. Probably leave that for later. Thanks very much for inviting us. It's the postgraduate and beyond that kind of does put strike terror into our hearts, really, because we're not currently involved, either of us, in an academic setting as you yourselves are. So it's a privilege for us to be here as well. And I mentioned migration, so I'm getting off piece already. Sorry about that. This morning, Mr. Cameron said we were going to take, now going to take thousands of Syrian refugees, as well as made a statement on that. And yesterday, the Archbishop of Canterbury issued a statement, or a statement in his name was issued. And the day before yesterday, on Wednesday, the Archbishop sort of had an off-record hours meeting with David Cameron about all and sundry, including this issue. Obviously, that was a private meeting, no one knows what to say. 2 weeks ago, I was in touch with the Archbishop's social and political affairs advisor, Jack, saying, I think it's getting a bit embarrassing that Lambeth isn't saying anything about this. In fact, I've been saying that for the last 6 months. So it was left to one or two individual bishops to make statements, which don't necessarily all come off the middle of the bat, you know, from the church point of view. And what we're going to talk about this afternoon is about the practicalities of this. Another project I've done is to research what local churches around the country are doing to support refugees in their own towns and cities. And so I've got 11 areas where I've just summarised what local churches and interfaith groups are doing, and often projects which have gone far beyond the faith communities but were started usually by councils to work Christians together in such a place and so forth. Anyway, the dynamics of power and authority sort of move in very subtle ways between what's going on locally and what's going on in the media and everything in between. And all we want to do is just to confuse ourselves further about the complexities of that sort of network. I don't know who's operating the
In that case, we need to be on the slideshow.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Oh, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Shall I? No, but we didn't want to.
No, I can do that, that's all right. We've got Harry. It's okay.
I just want to move this around.
Brilliant. So that was the title, which I can't remember, it emerged, I think, didn't it? Maybe from, not from Randall's cane, but from elsewhere. We're conscious in talking about power and authority that these are very controverted and difficult terms to balance, particularly. But it's lucky in some ways, not in others, that power and authority are both very New Testament words. The word dunamis and the word ecclesia, and it's not sure I wasn't entirely literate in New Testament, it was in some bad old days, about 30 years ago, when you taught whatever no one else wanted to teach. However, dunamis and ecclesia sort of run through, I mean, Mark's gospel in particular, the notion of ecclesia, the authority, the self-authenticating authority of Jesus as the power of his kind of personality in Mark's gospel comes through, whereas the authority of the Messiah in Matthew is more legitimated in terms of the fulfillment of prophecy and so on. Luke's gospel, the response of the crowds, the joy and wonder of the crowds at the wonderful things he said and did, kind of legitimated authority. In John, there's a more, seems a more internal kind of authority. Those are caricatures of what one might say, but throughout the New Testament, and of course through the Hebrew scriptures as well, these notions of power, but actually the ability to get things done, and authority, the legitimated structure within which authority is given to particular people or institutions, there's a constant interplay, as we know, from the earliest days of the Israelite monarchy and further back than that. So there's a lot of richness in the Christian tradition and different forms of legitimation of authority. And that, of course, resonates with the current political situation here, where the nature of authority is, particularly in the Labour Party, very controverted in itself. What kind of authority? Is it a consensual authority? Is it the authority which, resonating with the concerns of the country at large, sort of convey to a person, or is it the authority which, speaking out of conviction, like Margaret Thatcher or Jeremy Corbyn, carries through? So these are the kind of issues that we're opening up, whether it's in Mark's Gospel, whether it's looking for someone to sort out the drug issue in athletics. We look for someone with authority. Will Lord Coe be able to be that person? Time will tell. But a lot is invested in who has the power, often economically, and who has the authority, and whether the authority actually can have any traction and be real authority. And the authority of God in all this is equally difficult to pin down. What is the practical cash value of the authority of God, now that we no longer believe in the divine right of kings or even queens? So that's just a kind of introduction, not to say that we're competent to deal with the kind of theological issues, but we're kind of aware that there is a big, difficult world of understanding power and authority out there. Anna's introduced us really well. Elizabeth, do you want to say anything more about yourself and your role?
I was just musing on power and authority, and of course amongst black and other minority ethnic communities, power and authority is something that really has over time, and the historical legacies and the current experience of power and authority, be it both within the church and outside of the church, in secular society, has not overall been necessarily a very pleasant experience. And certainly the questions around power and authority amongst many black and minority ethnic communities is how is power and authority exercised upon us, as opposed to how is it used to help us, to progress us and to support us. So there's real contradictions there, isn't there? You know, the way it's seen. Yeah. So introduce myself. Well, I think Anna gave a great introduction around that. And one of the things was, in addition to working in America for quite a number of years, I also worked in international development for 10 years and worked around the world, and predominantly Africa and Asian continents is where I worked. And I was always struck that the very, very different stories in Africa and Asia than in England. And so, you know, the stories that we hear in England, or even the experiences that we have in England, and that the way we understand our place in the world is very, very different. The very first time I went to Africa, I don't know quite what happened, and this is a very personal experience for me. And I could only, in thinking about it, and in thinking about how I felt in Africa, the first country in Africa I went to was Kenya, was that it was the first time in my life where I had experienced not being the only person of my complexion in the room, not being the only person, and being as equal as everybody else in that society, irrespective. And it really was a very, very palpable experience and feeling that I took away from there, actually seeing leaders, people in all walks of life, who their complexions were non-black, where their complexions were black, of course, as opposed to everywhere else I had been in the world. And that made a very big difference to, one, how they saw the world and their place in the world, and also how I saw my place in the world, because things changed a lot for me after that. I didn't expect to share that, but as I said to you, it just depends what comes out, so we share. I think you probably know as much about my background, certainly my professional background, from what Anna shared. I've been working with the National Church Institutions, like the Church of England, for 2.5 years. And the reason that I accepted this job was because I was very, very angry with the church. Very angry indeed. And very angry at what I saw was the church's absence around issues of justice. And that angered me a lot. And also, additionally, I felt that the church's absence in society, and by that I meant, for me, its physical absence, the buildings and everything, yes, I think pretty much most of us are familiar with our buildings, whether you are a churchgoer or not, you're very familiar with it. They're sort of like Walmarts in America, they're on every corner, aren't they? So we don't have a problem with that, but what we do seem to have a problem with societally is, who is the church and what role do they play? And I'm really talking about from a justice perspective here, so I'm not trying to extend our discussion, I think it's wide enough as it is. So yeah, I shall leave my instruction at that.
Thanks. Our boss is Malcolm Brown, he's the director, and he's been to this seminar, I think, before, and I know he got a bit of comeback from that, so
that's,
I keep banging on about the Church of England. We apologise for that, that's where we come from, and what we know. The Church of England is, even more than other churches, a place of very dispersed authority, as you know. And it's commonplace that the media pick up something as being the voice of the Church of England, and it becomes difficult.
Yeah.
For example, the issue of mitochondrial replacement came up a few months ago. There was legislation going through Parliament. This is where, in principle, it's kind of possible for a child to have three parents in genetic terms, to caricature it. And it kind of blew up in the church's face because someone in our team was briefing and representing a sort of agreed view, and one or two other people in the church came up with other views. And this is happening all the time. It doesn't always lead to sort of such a public standoff as it did in that case. But as we know, there are leaders within the churches and the faith communities who have their own personal authority and speak for them, and it's good that they do. So it's strange how much people care what bishops say, particularly in local areas. And it's probably not strange, how little notice people take what synods say. This decision making body is the general synod, but very little kind of real grip that sort of the proceedings of the synod have, except just occasionally when it catches a moment and something is passed.
Can I put that
give an
example?
Yeah.
And I absolutely agree with that. Sometimes I think that, you know, there's almost 500 members of synod, and I sometimes wonder why. Yeah. What for? What's the purpose? But I do have to say that one direct thing in relation to my area of work was that a synod member raised a question a few years ago with regards to participation and membership of clergy, participation and membership of far right and extremist groups. And actually, as a result of that, which was a huge amount of work, but as a result of that, there was an addition to the clergy disciplinary measure. So there was a real direct action taken from a question that had been asked some years before in synod, which actually I think that's probably the way synod should work, but rarely works. So that's the one I can think of where the clergy disciplinary measure changed to make it clear that clergy, it would be considered a disciplinary, the need for disciplinary action should clergy be members of any far-right or extremist groups.
Thank you. So synod has uses. Certainly has uses. At the moment, there's a government consultation open on support for asylum seekers. Been a running issue, and this government has cut, having held it at the same level, only dropping in real terms for a number of years, it's now cutting it. And it's been very useful that in 2004 the General Synod passed a motion overwhelmingly about asylum support and also about the right to work for asylum seekers, which is so much about it's almost non-existent. But it's very useful to be able to have that marker in the sand that the Synod actually did pass this motion. That is the mind of the Church in a fairly definite sense, so there's kind of an authority behind that. And when you read through the debates of the General Synod, the strength of them, when there's a good debate, is the local input from the diocese and people saying, well, in my area this, in my area that. I was talking a couple of weeks ago to someone from one of the Midlands dioceses about the cost of applying for citizenship, which is now fees just over £1,000 to apply for citizenship. No matter whether you get it or not, you don't get it, you've lost £1,000. So an awful lot of people in this area, in the Midlands, in this parish, where this parish priest was ringing me up with that, can't afford £1,000 for the mayor of Pookie case. The mayor had independently been to remain for a sufficient number of years to make their application credible, but they're only going to get £1,000 from. And that's probably going to come to a diocesan synod motion and then would come to a general synod possibly. So. A lot of what we do is kind of these things which are kind of work in progress, and eventually may or may not see the light of day. Ecumenically, we work quite a bit. You mentioned in your introduction the Church's Refugee Network, which meets about every quarter, and actually which is meeting next Tuesday, which represents a number of church groups, and also actually we have the Jewish Council on Racial Equality, taking quite a lead on migrant issues, who are coming. We'll be coming to one or two meetings. And that includes particularly people from the Joint Public Issues team, which is from the Baptist, Methodist, United Reformed Churches, and from Catholic Social Action Network, Caritas, across denominations. And working in that way, it's obviously slower and more dispersed. You don't have even less than a single denomination. You can't quite marshal the troops quite so well. And yet, there is a certain freedom in a group like that, which doesn't purport to be a representative body. It consists of basically enthusiasts from different denominations. It's chaired by Bishop of Croydon. Amazing how many bodies are sort of find consolation in being chaired by a church building bishop. Safety in it. That's right. And there is a certain amount of ecumenical action, and churches together in Britain and Ireland, and churches together in England. probably don't have quite the same profile they did 20 or 30 years ago when this kind of the ecumenical movement and sense of dynamic and thrust and forward movement and hope about it, about actual structural convergence of denominations. That's kind of melted away, really. But these bodies still have quite an important role, particularly through their presidents. Gives a voice to the minority. Churches that represent minority groups.
Yeah, exactly. We have the Churches Network for Gypsy Travel Aroma as well. You know, some of you may remember the Dale Farm debacle, in which the families, those traveller families, had actually bought that land and understood it to be theirs, but that were forcibly removed from that land. And one of the things that was really very obvious during that time, and particularly when they were being evicted, was that the Church of England, the Church of England was absolutely, we never said anything. We there is no report of somebody, particularly the leadership, saying anything in relation to that. But we now have brought under, I suppose, in terms of hosting, we don't run it, but there is the Churches Network for Gypsy Traveller Aroma, which again is an ecumenical group. The feeling being that we are better together and certainly stronger together.
Sorry, the natural posture of the church in recent years has been on the side of vulnerable and marginalised people. And these words are used so much that it becomes difficult to know quite what they mean anymore. Sort of vulnerable people has become a sort of shorthand for an awful lot of different kinds of people. And one begins to feel that people almost see it coming as a sort of dog whistle word for kind of wet old-fashioned liberalism sort of thing, so it's stating it, but it's become a word which is obviously very important, particularly for Christian people and people of faith generally. And yet, the number of issues that we talk about, whether it's FGM, whether it's trafficking, whether it's sort of whole modern slavery agenda, which last year took up a lot of time for us, and it's still just as real now. So many people are vulnerable in different ways that when we talk about minorities in a minute, and again, whether that what kind of a category that is, and whether it's quite as neutral a concept as we may gain.
Because embedded within it is this paternalism, and there's a paternalism about vulnerability that we seem to operate. And so we say people are vulnerable. And you know, when we think about empire and colonialism, you can't separate these things. All these things are all connected. And you stop using words like vulnerable. And what that is okay, so how does the imperial society, the colonial society, i.e. the Western society, who very much seems to be the standard. And we see it's almost as if we're saying, well, Western society is the standard, this is what we must aspire to, and everything else is degrees away from there. And so we call people vulnerable, or we call communities vulnerable, and therefore we as the paternal carers for vulnerable people can then go in and do what we feel is necessary to do to make them not vulnerable anymore. Which doesn't usually work, and we'll talk more about that as we go along.
Thank you. Yes. Where the churches touch vulnerable people is in the local area, which is why I put the church and the authority of the local. That it is in places where people are actually vulnerable. One of the areas I have to do with is gambling. Issues in the last year or so more about slot betting terminals in high street betting shops. Because there's the law is that you can only have a maximum of four B2 machines, as they're called, these high stake machines where you can bet £100 at a time. You know, four in one shop, therefore shops proliferate so that each has four machines in it. And I went to speak to a deanery synod in near Kent, where the high street is full of betting shops. And people were standing out and talking about their own problems in the way that a GP talked about a number of people who came into his practice who had real problems with addictions and problem gambling. And it's at that local level, which we, sitting in Westminster for most of the time, find ourselves very frustrated, don't we, that you can't be everywhere and be in touch with, you know, sort of fantasies about being in touch with what's going on around the country, which it's always impossible to do if you're sitting in Westminster. And but it's so important that we are in touch to some extent, and that the local churches don't feel that the centre is so just somewhere else completely. And we want to loop this back to our Lord himself and the way in which Jesus particularly targeted, almost focused on, prioritised vulnerable people. And we understand vulnerability in terms of most of the people to whom Jesus chose to speak. And yet, without any other contradictions in our life, we sit in this building in Westminster opposite the Department for Education, which is an incarnation of the established church and established interests and vested interests of various kinds. And the church is kind of the fourth estate of the Lord. It's one of the three estates of the realm, the more spiritual in the Lords and that kind of thing. And so at the moment of our time, I spent briefing bishops in the Lords about issues going through. And so the church is, from one point of view, helplessly compromised with the establishment of power as we've inherited it from previous generations and as it continues to be alive and well. And to be at a place which is the opposite end of the system from those who are at the margins of it. And that is, I think that's a painful antinomy which people who would be working in the church always, or a part of the church, always struggle with. And especially the Church of England is an established church, a contradiction in terms. Should a church be something which is unestablished, obviously disestablished, but is the opposite of something which is identified with and somehow coterminous with a kind of secular establishment of power? You will have noticed, by the way, that whereas I think the Amazon's programme may have suggested that we were each going to give a talk followed by questions, that we're kind of having a conversation, and this conversation is going to move to Elizabeth, but I think we're very happy for people to kind of chip in as we
go. We have that kind of work today. I mean, so we could just for a second now just say any thoughts thus far. Well, I'm sure there's thoughts, but anything you want to share thus far. You really this quiet.
It's all right, I don't get going. There's another time when I have no choice.
Yeah, we shall make it.
Talk to you.
It's interesting, isn't it, about language and labels. So the labels like marginalised and the minorities. They're very, very contentious labels, these labels. And so we talk about ethnic minority. And we talk about minority ethnic and people are sort of, but we also talk about ethnic. So I was reading something coming here on the train, and actually it was an academic paper, and I was quite perturbed to see that they used the term ethnic to apply to black and other visible minority ethnic people, and that's strange even in academia. So in other words, they talked about ethnics in this paper, and quite clearly the ethnics were the others. And so it's this whole process of othering and using terms like minority. First of all, as we understand that word, minority means smaller than, and it's smaller than the majority, therefore. And so already there, within a Western construct, that suggests weaker than too. And I could go back to the discussion we had just a few minutes ago about paternalism, but I just ask you to join up those dots, because it's very clear that all of this works together. It also can be and is minority particularly and marginalised. Offensive labels to use. We could say, why use labels at all? Why do we have to have these distinctions? And I could go back as far as race, because we know that that's a classification. And so, you know, I can't take you right back all the way there, because that's too long a discussion for us to have. But I'm just showing you how that works. So we talk ethnic food. What is ethnic food? It seems that we suddenly understand that to be anything that isn't sort of the traditional fish and chips, although isn't curry our national dish now? We're not fish and chips anymore. But do you see what I'm saying? It's sort of it's labelling people and it's defining them. It's defining people and defining groups by these particular labels. And these labels are othering labels, because they are other than the standard, and the standard being white. And those are separating and segregating titles. I've had quite a number of communications from Anglicans around the country who we may have sent some publication to, we may have sent some notice to about something, and I hear this constantly: do not call me minority. I am not minority ethnic. I am a black person, or I'm an Asian person, or whatever, but I'm not minority ethnic, and I do not wish to be identified by that label. So there's real difficulties. There's real difficulties around this labelling, and of course the whole idea around minority brings us back to vulnerable and all of that. So the thing is, whoever is the authority with who is doing the labelling. So if we decide, i.e. we societally, and I'm talking about within Western society, which is the majority ethnicity being white, decide that the title is migrant, or decide that the title is a minority, where is that authority there? And what is that message that is being sent, and what is the message that is being received? And those are the questions that ask. Now, that last question, I kind of thought we might throw that out just before I answer that a little bit. So why does a white middle-class church have a guilt complex? Anybody want to throw anything out at that? Or does it have a guilt complex?
I'll try. Mm-hmm. As you were talking about ethnic and the kind of problems with that term that made this film that came out in America last year called Dear White People.
Yeah.
And if you haven't seen the film, go see it. Maybe tonight or late this weekend.
Yeah.
They highlight the way in which, in that film, in which whiteness is a kind of hollow core in terms of it's an ethnic identity with nothingness in the center.
Yeah.
There's a sense in which I think as critical white studies are starting to indicate, white people want to have a culture, and we don't. And so there's this gaze towards the other, the ethnic other, with a sense of jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not acknowledged, it doesn't come to the foreground, mm-hmm. but that's part of the dynamic. And some mm-hmm. guilt colludes with jealousy in a mm-hmm. complicated dance. Maybe you could react to that, or maybe some of my colleagues could refute that.
Well, it's an interesting approach, isn't it? And I have seen that film, and it is good, so you should go and see it. But I think that sort of struggle, and if we label that as jealousy, if we title that as jealousy, then we could say, okay, so what happens as a result of that jealousy, and therefore, you know, from on the receiving end, we would start talking about the inequalities that we face as a result. But the thing about it is, this whole thing about minority and majority, etc., is what we know, and what is unequivocal, is it isn't about numbers. It has absolutely nothing to do with numbers. So if you take South Africa, for instance, and apartheid, had nothing to do with numbers, because actually the minority oppressed the majority. And so it's about power. And it's not about numbers. But the problem with the labelling is First of all, there's the racializing of groups. And so when you look at, for instance, white ethnicity, we talk about white, you don't often see that. You won't often see this, you know, this label white keep being applied as you will black and minority ethnic, but you won't often see it. But within that, there has already been historically and currently a racialization process that has occurred as a result of those labels. And let me give you a practical example of that. Some of you may remember that in 1997, Mike Tyson, the boxer, bit off part of Evander Holyfield's ear. What you may or may not remember is some of the headlines that followed that, one headline said savage, another headline said beast. Now, there are links between all of that and historical legacy, because the racialization of particularly black men is what I'm talking about now. That really fitted in really well with that racialization process, because black men, as a stereotype and as racialized, are considered to be strong, considered to be not very easily controlled, not very bright, etc., etc. Now, what was interesting was a couple of months later, a rugby union player bit off part of an ear of another rugby union player in London during a game. It didn't reach the papers at all. It did reach the sports papers, but there was no such descriptors that described the Kenny, I think his name was, the person who bit off the other person's ear. But there were no, so that's all of that links in with when you have these labels like minority and like marginalised, that's part of a racialisation process that sort of shapes our understanding and our thinking of how we think about people that identify with those labels or that we identify with those labels. So back to the guilt complex of the middle class church.
I was wondering if it links to something that you were saying about before, as the guilt as kind of a learned helplessness, that there's so much that needs to be done, and as to be like Chris, there's so much that needs to be done, and there's no way I can do much of it. I wonder if that then links to what you were talking about, the kind of passivity. That there may be a link between that and guilt.
Yeah, there may be. I said to you before that I worked 10 years in international development, and I do remember very, very well that when I first started working in international development, I was completely overwhelmed. I was completely overwhelmed by the sheer amount of work that I thought needed to be done, or that did need to be done. Does one then become helpless in the face of that? And maybe that helplessness becomes, well, there's nothing I can do, so therefore. Or does one say, well, you know, we can move one step at a time here. We can make some difference. We can't change everything, and certainly not all at once. But it shouldn't freeze us into that. And, you know, along with that learned helplessness that you talk about is a process of internalization. And so, you know, you could liken that to self-fulfilling prophecy. And so, you know, if I showed you a picture now, if I showed you an image now of, you know, bring this image up in your mind, a young black male, and he's walking ahead of you in the street, and his pants are down beyond his backside, and he has got a certain walk. I'm not asking you to say what you're at, but let's generalise about it, as opposed to you saying, well, this is what I think of somebody like that. But as a generalisation, what do you think are the assumptions that would be made about that person? Lots of
noise. That they'd be dangerous?
Yeah. Slacking, maybe. Dangerous, slacking, you know, obviously doesn't know how to dress properly, and you know it's rather offensive. They can't sit down, his legs and you know his backside is hanging out, or they can see his back. But do you know what I mean? So we already build that up, and we make those links quite immediately because we have been racialized into ideas about particular groups, and that could be, you know, I could have said, you know, if you see a white male dressed in a suit and the suit has sort of silkish lapels and he's got a bow tie on, what's the picture you concur from that? So it's the same thing, but we do, and we've built this up through those processes. I want to just very quickly get back to the church. Why would a white middle class church? Well, CIMIAC, which is the Committee for Minority Ethnic Anglican Concerns, which is a committee of the Archbishop's Council and the committee that I'm the officer to, has been around in the Church of England for 30 years almost. We're fast approaching 30 years. It came about as a result of a report called Faith in the City. What was very interesting, however, and this comes back to a power dynamic as well, is that there was a recommendation within that there needed to be a body, and what was asked for was a commission to really examine the lack of inclusion and representation of black and minority ethnic people in the life of the church, and to shape policy and action to redress that. What was very, very interesting is actually that the church, i.e. the governing body, and that would be the synod in its councils, said, no, we can't have a commission. We're not going to have a commission. And Philip Giddings, who I think was the chair at the time, Philip Giddings in his comments said, quite simply, it was very, very sad that we refused to allow that. And the reality of it was, taking consideration of the debate in which that decision was made, was that the majority ethnic group, i.e. the white majority, could not accept a minority ethnic commission telling them what they needed to do to balance and to write this. So what that suggests then is that while there was a willingness to have this report, Faith in the City, and to accept this report into synod, there was not that willingness to then follow through with what the recommendations were within that report. So what then happened was, no, we won't have a commission, we will have a committee, and that committee will report to the Archbishop's Council. Well, I'm sure, as you know, when you have committees that report into a council, they're not really doing bodies. They're not really action bodies, they're report writing bodies, and they report. So what actually happens now is we have a whole slew of reports that have gone from CIMIAC to the Archbishop's Council, to the General Synod, which have then passed back to Synod for passed back to CIMIAC for action. Doesn't work, because CIMIAC cannot action it can recommend it. So why does this church have, for that reason, but if you go back a little bit further, I think some of you will be familiar with and know that when we had the first mass migration to this country of people from colonised countries, and particularly the Caribbean, my father was one of them, who were lifelong Anglicans, very accustomed to worshipping in Anglican churches, interestingly in the West Indies, who all had white priests. So very, very accustomed to that, and very accustomed to the fellowship of that faith. But when they came here, understanding that they were to be welcomed, and found that actually society didn't welcome them, and society didn't want them, society didn't like it, but felt that they would find certainly a welcome in the church, because this was their church, after all. But sadly did not find a welcome in the church. What they found was an unwelcome in the church. So there are many reasons, and I'll just go back one stage further, which is many hundreds of years, which is the role of the church in slavery, and the fact that the church itself owned plantations, and that the church profited not only from those plantations, but at the abolition of slavery, the church profited due to the loss of its property, and its property, of course, were slaves. So that's the guilt of our church. Shall we ask them again? So those who, see now is a film that is very, very new. We launched this film at the Synod in July in York. Let me just give you just a little bit of background before we press play. It's called I Too Am C of E. And that title was deliberately chosen and selected. And it was inspired by the campaign on the Harvard the Harvard campus in America, in which African American students had a silent campaign, I too am Harvard. And it was then picked up by Oxford students here, and Black and minority ethnic students. Oxford had a very similar campaign, which said, I too am Oxford. What was very, very interesting about their campaign, though, was that another group of students at Oxford, who apparently were quite offended or upset that some of their peers may feel it necessary to establish that they are Oxford, began a counter-campaign called We Are All Oxford, which actually muted the whole point of the campaign in the first place. And what was interesting was when they were interviewed about that, they said, well, we didn't want to silence our peers. No, we did. That's exactly what you wanted to do. But anyway, so we were inspired by that. Why were we inspired by that? Because within our church we have massive underrepresentation of minority ethnic Anglicans at all levels in the life of the church. And because, as I said, for 30 years there has been a committee who has tried very, very hard to represent those groups and to inform the church of where the issues are and what needs to be done about those issues in order for us to truly represent the body and the kingdom. And let's go on to the film.
Born and baptized into the church at 6 months old. So I've known no other church. This is my church. I grew up in the Caribbean, seeing reflections of myself in leadership within the church, within society as a whole. And then I came to England in 1979 as a teenager. And I looked around me and I couldn't see reflections of myself in leadership within the Church of England.
It's hard to describe to someone who is used to being the majority culture what it's like walking into a church and feeling like you're the only one. It's just a very hard feeling to capture, and I guess minorities from every ethnic group just learn to deal with that.
If you don't see yourself, then you don't know that you are welcome, that you can be part of.
And so even though the church itself can be saying with words, you belong, you're welcome, everything about the situation communicates to you, I'm not part of this and I'm not welcome. Well, CMAC's been around for almost 30 years, it'll be 30 years next year in 2016. And throughout that time it's assisted the Church of England with work around minority ethnic Anglican concerns. But the fact that we're still 30 years on and talking about the same things, I think that's the challenge for us, really. For people to feel that the church is for them, they want to be able to see that they are welcomed in, not just by words, but by actions. And actually, one of the ways that happens is as people see leaders of similar skin colour, ethnicity to them, in positions of leadership, saying, come in, this is for you. Wherever there's a formal structure, where there's a hierarchy, barriers will exist. Now, they can be intentional or unintentional. I think the challenge is that we've got to try and recognise what those barriers are, and we need to do everything in our powers to remove them.
I think it's okay to feel prejudiced or to have these thoughts, but I think one needs to be prepared to confront it and talk about it and make the changes.
And I remember in a rural deanery saying to them, what if you had a vacancy and I applied for it? Would you consider me? And this dear elderly church warden said, we have no black people here, so why would we want to appoint you in a position like this?
For I myself have struggled, actually, even though I have got lots of gifts that can be used outside my church. It has taken a very long time for me to get involved. It wasn't that I didn't have the gift. I was just not the right colour, which is very hard to say, but that's true.
We're all uniquely gifted by God. And so if there are a group of people who aren't coming into the Church of England, that is to the detriment of the whole, because God has made each individual special and unique and with particular gifts that are useful in the service of his kingdom. And so if there's a whole group of people who we're neglecting to reach, well, then we're in big trouble, because God has gifted those people for a purpose, and we want to be part of the blessing that he wants to give to his people.
When one gets across those kind of differences, there's so much that actually connects, and there's so much richness which is being lost.
My name is Sheffrins. I got baptised and confirmed 3 years ago into the Church of England. It's really important to have black people as a leader, because it gives people more hope to be like, okay, I want to be like this person, I can do this.
A few years ago, I met a young man, 25 years old, so same ethnicity as me, and he'd just become a Christian. So although he was welcomed in by me and others, in practice he felt like this was a place that wasn't for him. He saw the lack of familiar faces, if you like, within the Church of England, and thought that this wasn't a place that really welcomed him, and so he went elsewhere.
So it seems to me that even at a character level, we're not getting the clergy who have black people in their churches encouraging them to offer themselves for ministry.
The thing that most encouraged me to go into ministry were those people who came alongside me and said, you may not feel like this is for you, but let me encourage you. You have the gifts and the potential, and even though maybe you don't see people like yourself here, this could be you. And I think we need more of that, more people who would just get alongside young people who are just in the process of beginning to think these things through.
When I spoke in my maiden speech in July 2011, I said that we didn't know what to call it, unfinished business. We ought to actually call it business barely started. And I think we've moved on from that point now. We're in a positive place, but the challenge really is for us to progress it.
As a church, we cannot be telling those across the road in Parliament to do this and do the other if we don't get our own house in order. And so it's a great challenge for the church.
What I want to get across, I suppose, is that it's not about just being nice and welcoming. I think people are. But I think it's to go beyond that, to actually, in some way, really taking steps to include, to nurture, to have opportunities for people from other backgrounds coming in.
That starts just with the words that we use, but I think it has to go further than that, so that when I do walk into the church, I do see a leadership that begins to represent the wealth of diversity and gifts that we have in this country.
I think that gives a very good picture to the diverse world that we live in, that there is unity in Jesus Christ, which I think it's an attractive thing for people, for young people.
And one of the things said about the first Christians in the Acts of the Apostles was, see how they love one another. Now that love needs to be shown in action.
And so for me, the future of the Church of England looks like a church that says, we need to remain faithful to the Scriptures, faithful to Christ. But how do we change for the sake of the kingdom of God? How do we include the people who aren't being included, so that the church that we build is like a city on the hill, that people look at and think, this is what I want to be part of, and this is where I belong.
Besides the very obvious reasons that why is it important to have ethnic diversity around the table, it's a gospel imperative, we know that already, don't we? We know too around the issues of inclusion, I think it's all been expanded on well enough in the film. But I'm going to give you another example of why it's important and how that exclusion in terms of policy and in terms of practice then is seen. So you're probably all familiar with the fact that the church has been working very, very hard at having women in the episcopate, and that there has been a number of ideas around that and a number of schools of thought around whether that should or should not happen. And thankfully and joyfully, yes, it has. And we now have, just named on Monday, I think, the Bishop of Newcastle, we now have 7 women bishops in the space of a few months, and that is much to rejoice. Very, very much to rejoice. In the process of that whole action being taken, the bishops decided, the House of Bishops decided that one of the ways to help progress this, we were actually literally at the point anyway of where it was going to happen, but in order to not necessarily force it but to progress it happening, the bishops decided that they would allow 8 women into the House of Bishops as observers. They would not be able to vote because you have to be a bishop to vote. But they would be observers. And they felt that that would be a very, very important move in terms of presence, in terms of participation, influence, etc. Well, that's a very, very good move. So in preparing for this, a group called the Transformations Group was established. Not particularly because of the House of Bishops, but that was part of the preparation of women in the episcopate. And each diocesan bishop was asked to nominate 2 women to be part of this group who would, who would do this work. Not one diocesan bishop nominated a minority ethnic woman. Not one. So in that whole group of women, of which there were over 80 women, there wasn't one black or minority ethnic woman amongst that group. So, there's a whole big issue besides the very important gospel imperative, besides the very important inclusion of, if we don't see people that look like ourselves, as was said on the film, then you cannot see yourself in that place, but neither can others. So no bishop obviously could see. Now, it's not to say all of those bishops got together and said, well, let's not have any black or minority ethnic women in this group. That just did not happen. But the result happened. When you think about what I said to you earlier about racialization, etc. So that happened. And so there is no influence from black or minority ethnic women in that whole debate, which was a shame and a loss, I think.
It's actually
quite cool. Okay, so I think it's time for you to do a bit of work now, because we talked a lot. So we're just going to give you a few minutes to think about something, and then let's just have a chat about it. Let's talk about it. So can you see that from there? Because I know some of it's pretty faint. So I want you to consider and discuss the accuracy of these two polar opposite statements. So David Cameron said, I think he said that in 2011, we are living in a post-racial society. It's been said by a number of people, but for obvious reasons I'm using David Cameron. And Dr. Martin Luther King said, racism still occupies the throne of our nation, and that was in around about 63, 64, 67. Yeah. Okay, I can't quite remember. But anyway, what I'd like you to do is, in the context of the UK, not in the context necessarily of the world at the moment, but in the context of the UK. Can you just split down the middle? Because if you're all sort of trying to talk to each other, or actually I wonder if, is it easier to split down the middle, or maybe into how many are there? 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and then that would be two. You can either split down the middle and do it, or do it groups, yeah, split down the middle. So actually, you're on this list. We're about 5 minutes on this.
Well, I'm Australian, so I certainly don't hesitate to comment on British society. So I can speak about my
own society.
And one reason for the story in our society was a Indigenous Australian.
I think, so I went to a school in Scotland. It was 2,000 students, four of whom were not white. So my childhood was fairly monochromatic, except for a year in States where I was one of the only white people and bullied for being white. Bizarrely, that's an unusual thing I think in the States. So that was, I have very little experience for most of my childhood of race even being an issue locally, just because it was a white town.
Aboriginal
wardens in front of the opposition fans. I suspect that's actually the case for quite a lot of places. I would have expected rurally maybe this is wrong, but rurally I would have expected to be predominantly white. Whereas if you're growing up in London, you've probably got a very, very different experience.
And this became a huge issue at the time. And I believe
some of the countries are pre-racial
societies.
I think it's a fair comment that the UK is not one country in regards. I live in East London. I'm probably as white in the minority as Christian. And when I used to work in the city, my boss was from Africa. No questions asked. But go to Durham, and at least in the undergraduate's life, there are very, very few ethnic minorities, and it's known because Durham is such a white
place.
It's interesting that we have an American and British comment. I mean, there's obviously 40, 50 years between the comments, but it does seem as though in America there's much more. I mean, there's a clearer, more open argument about it, or debate about it. I think of France Fanon in the French context saying, you know, looking at America and saying, in America, there's actually, this is an argument, in fact, it's a violent fight. In France, when I bring this up, people just say, oh, you know, and there's kind of I just get indifference when I bring up the issue of colonialism and that's France, this is Britain, and my experience in Britain would be there's less open discourse about it, and there's clearly less violence about it. So in that sense, it's not the racial discourse is something that's not as public and forthright. I don't think that means it's post-racial. That's an accurate statement, I think, because it's not as public discussed.
It's interesting because I wonder if it's like there's kind of these different layers going on where like our churches have things like representation, though there isn't representation necessarily in leadership. And it seems as if there's kind of pockets where there's just this seems to be a question of fluidity, especially if you're living in East London, there's just. I mean, it's and yet these places are communities and it's kind of inclusive in that way. And yet the representation is a part of society. There's this disparity. It almost seems like there's pockets where it's a real fluidity. The teacher turned to me, and then I realized that doesn't inherit it, doesn't disinherit it, and this is not inherited, but just me that is in class because I don't have a but I was able to speak about colonialism. So it's very open environment. That was something that you could talk about, like how you felt, but like now where I am at, Exeter is like white middle class, like, it's almost no forward. So when I get into it, even just I practically stick up because one of the only agents in the church as well. It's not something you can think about. They kind of teach you like you're still like a missionary college. Like, you need saving. So whenever I talk about you,
okay, it's 5 minutes, so I'm going to have to
ask. Funny. So,
you share any? Do you wish to, or would you like to share any of about the very short, brief discussion?
Passion progress, I think.
Yeah. With regards to that, yeah.
I grew up going to a school in Scotland of 2,000 people, I think, and I think there are 4 non-white students. So I think there would be quite a lot of parts of the country, especially rural areas, where I said pre-racial. It's not pre-racial at all. It's just no direct engagement. And so there's not the chance to see prejudices come out that would probably come out. So a lack of debate, lack of engagement in those places for very obvious reasons.
Because there aren't, because there aren't.
Yeah, just because there isn't the opportunity to.
I challenge that.
Okay.
I challenge that quite strongly. Because I think that we tend to be under the impression that where these issues arise is that there are communities, where there are black communities or other visible minority communities, and we know that just isn't true. Because actually, remember we talked about the thought processes before, we talked about racialization and the understanding of race, etc. Where that all happens is not necessarily when you come into contact with black or other minority ethnic communities. That happens at a much, much higher level. And so for instance, Martin shared the talk about migration, he's coming back to that, I know. But when we see these labels, so if we took the headlines now, and we could take any headlines, but when we see these labels, when we hear about this, there's all sorts of influences on our thoughts. So through social media, through television, through all sorts of media. That's where it happens. It's not necessarily where you're seeing people. And I'll give it, again, I have a practical example to give you. One of the members of the church's network for Gypsy Traveller Rose was sharing a story with me, and she said that she was at her church, and she was in the church garden tending to the garden, and one of the parishioners walked past, and without any prompt whatsoever, I'm paraphrasing the remark because I can't remember the exact words, but I think you'll get the sentiment of what I'm saying. Made a remark to her about if she blocked off the water tap, if she removed the water tap, then they would no longer have those, and I won't use the descriptors that we use to identify the people, but it was talking about the gypsy community who came to the church to use the water. And to get water from the water tap, and in his head he felt that the thing to do was to take it off because otherwise they had to deal with gypsies. And again, so that was, yes, definitely an interaction, but those ideas that he expressed around gypsies had nothing to do with his interaction with gypsies. It had to do with his beliefs and where he came from. I just wanted to say one more word, just because you used a phrase that was very interesting, that phrase non-white. I'm not going to go into all of that now, but I'd really, really like you to think about that phrase, because Martin and I just had a conversation while you were having a conversation about something Martin picked up from the film. We mentioned whiteness briefly today. There's not enough time to cover all of this stuff, but the idea of non-white as a label, not only is inaccurate, but it's highly wrong. Because what it suggests is white's the norm, and everything else is away from that norm. So white's the acceptable, but everything else isn't. And so I used a term earlier. I only briefly used it non-black, and I don't know if any of you picked up on that term. And actually, I was thinking about this last night. I was going to use that term all for this whole session, just to see if somebody would ask me about it, and if somebody would raise that. And also to ask you how you would have felt I was going to use it, but I didn't. To ask you at the end of the session, how did you feel about me using the term non-black throughout the session? Those are the things. So, does anybody have
I mean, just to add to that, in terms of ethnic minorities, mm-hmm. I know to my curiosity, not far from here, the ethnic minority was the travel community.
Right.
Where I am, just moved to Dorset, the ethnic minorities, I think, are Eastern European, and I was trying to kind of pick up languages in the playground yesterday, like, thinking it's not Russian, it's something, it? And that can hide the issues, we'll be looking to see how those relationships play out in the community.
Yeah, that masking of it, it does, yeah.
Mm. Maybe from... not quite Britain, but I mean, I don't agree with the accuracy of Cameron's statement for several reasons that you've identified. But I spent some time in France this summer. I was reading a theorist there who had worked as a psychologist, had been back and forth between a context of colonialism and France. And he said, comparing with America, he said, in France, we just get indifference when we point out racializing or colonialized structures and the kinds of psychological effects that they have on people. In America, there's an open fight about it.
Yeah.
So it's not indifference. It's. I mean, Martin Luther King quoted him. I mean, there's violence. There's open argument. But in France, it's just people look at us a bit confused and say, well, we're all the same. And there's a frustration that he was expressing about that. That kind of what he saw to be a denial or just an ignorance.
I love to add, obviously, you found this out now, that I do like telling stories, and it just prompted another one. I was working in France some years ago, and this was one of the few contracts that I worked on as a consultant with a private organisation, which was L'Oréal. And I was doing a piece of work with them, and the people who I was working with were all senior execs from all over the world. And the issues were about inequalities, and particularly racial inequalities, etc. And of course, where L'Oréal was coming from was the business case for diversity. Anyway, there was a huge amount of resistance in this room to the idea of racism, of racialized behaviour, etc. There was this huge amount of resistance in the room, and I was thinking about how could I work this, that because I'd rather people come to this idea themselves. I'm going to throw it out there, but then I want people to take it on, and I was thinking, how am I going to work with it? Anyway, so I came up with this scenario. So I gave them a scenario. They were up with, and I said, okay, so you have a job vacancy, and you've shortlisted and you're down to your final two. And you're about to interview. So the first person who comes in is a lady who appears to be of the Islamic faith, because she's wearing a hijab, not the full burqa, but the hijab. And I said, would you hire that lady? And all but one person said no. Without question, they would not hire her. The one person who said they would hire her said, well, I would if she agreed to not wearing a hijab. Okay. So I then said, okay, same situation. Here's your second. This is the second interview now. And the person comes in and is wearing a cross and chain. would you hire that person? And to a person, they all looked at me completely perplexed and wanted to know why I was even asking the question. Because they didn't understand, they had no understanding of that significance there. So they had immediately separated this out. The hijab was unacceptable, but they didn't understand when I said the significance of the cross and chain. For them, it was totally insignificant. And we did actually have a shift then, because that light bulb moment went off. I'm like, oh, right, that's it. We never thought we'd think like this and therefore act like this. So, you know, it's sort of automatic.
Should we
move on?
Yeah. I got my indiscreet remarks about Lambeth over earlier.
I mentioned
this with we're finished at 1:30. Is that right?
What time is it?
Sorry?
What time is it?
Oh, right. You ask the phone.
Yeah. We might jump over the next one.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just go.
Sorry, this has been a busy kind of session, kind of sort of landing on a number of issues about power and authority rather than trying to construct any kind of coherent edifice. And we kind of apologise for that, and we kind of don't. Then we talk about exclusion and marginalisation and the exercise of power and authority in our society. We're talking about some of the physical manifestations of that. And I spent nearly 15 years of my life working in prisons. The way in which this whole complex is developing in this country is an interesting matter, is it not? The way that the prison population has increased exponentially over the last 20 years or so. And the question whether, as in the United States, particularly in California and Texas, there's now a move to reduce the prison population, we simply can't afford that sort of gigantic prison industrial complex that's grown up at public expense, and now that's scaling back, and the advent of private prisons and the commercialisation of that whole area of life. I'm simply going to sort of sketch out the landscape as we talk about that. We're seeing an interesting context now where Mr. Grayling, the previous Secretary of State for Justice, had a very clear agenda, which Mr. Gove is now, in his kind of delicate way, dismantling bit by bit. is the impression, not dismantling it, that the whole privatisation of probation and so forth is not reversible and so forth will not be reversed. But Mr. Gove has kept his counsel very fairly closely to himself so far, but has made one speech in which he understandably put education at the heart of the prison system, but talked about governors having more responsibility and was very much wrote back on some of the prescribing changes. What we do with our children is important, and I mean it's been a step forward. Many of us would think that our country has come to recognise that people under 18 are children, which has been stated in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child for decades, and yet now, at last, in police stations, people of 17 are treated as though they're not adults, and now at last, a number of other measures are taken place to treat anyone under 18 as a child in need of some degree of protection, which is why the proposal from the last government, from the coalition government, about secure colleges for young people, and their proposal to build a large institution in Leicestershire, which would be in name a secure college, in fact a prison basically for children, most of you would be getting much further from home than under the present YMI system. It was very good that was kicked into touch, and we managed to get four bishops to go in and vote against it, and a couple to speak against it. And it's quite encouraging to work with some of the Lord Spiritual in some of these issues, and to see the way in which, for better or worse, that leverage can be used in some cases where as kind of cross-venture, often in liaison with other cross-ventures, and sometimes with a majority position, they can have quite a lot of influence. So the whole world of secure training colleges and secure children's homes, which are entirely privatised and run by G4S basically, contracts being re-let at the moment, but there's a whole world of children being incarcerated in places that we never really hear about very much. which the exclusion of those who are young people who we regard as unacceptable to live in society is an undervisited area. There was a fuss a couple of weeks ago when about Rainsbrook Secure Training Centre, which had a very damning inspectorate report, which the government has fought against. And there's a lot of argument about that. But there are many places in our country where people are being locked up, and the level of scrutiny, although it's better than in many countries, is still inadequate. Immigration removal centres, there's been a lot of focus on the Alswood and the detention of women. One of the great recent victories was the ending of the detention, supposed ending of the detention of children in immigration facilities. There are still children held, but not in the main immigration removal centres. But those are still relatively unregulated environments. And despite the moves to end indefinite detention, it is remarkable that we are almost the only country in Europe which has no time limit on the detention of people on the grounds of their migration status, their immigration status. And it was so encouraging that in the election, two of the main parties had it in their programmes and in their manifestos to do away with indefinite detention. That is now a sort of matter of history, but at least that was a kind of mark of the day. Secure hospitals, we incarcerate a lot of people in Broadmoor and Rampton and Ashworth, and again the level of scrutiny there is better than many places, but still not great. And alongside all this, we're developing this surveillance society, which a few years ago I've got a lot of anxiety about the level of CCTV coverage and the way surveillance was ramping up. And recently, it's fuss about communications data and the surveillance of our online activity. In the coalition government, there was an attempt to propose a communications data bill, regulating it to a large extent, allowing the monitoring of that information, and that will come back in the present government, we were told in the Queen's speech. So, again, are we doing enough to keep an eye ethically on the level of power and control exercised by the state and those institutions to which it delegates its authorities' powers in terms of that culture of control, which is the title of a book that's kind of set a lot going in the present discussion in this country. So, as well as the seen institutions, there are the unseen institutions of exclusion, which we do well, I think, to contemplate the way in which state control is being outsourced. Electronic monitoring, there was a big fuss about a couple of years ago about G4S and Serco, who were tagging people who were dead or left the country years ago and then charging the government for it, and they had to pay money back and so forth, but that was just continues regardless. And now there's, we're told there's in the coming immigration bill, which hasn't been published yet, there will be measures for the tagging of asylum seekers, basically. Now, certainly for people whose appeal rights have been exhausted, we'll wait to see what it is, but they've said they weren't going to increase the level of tagging of people so that people who committed no offence will be subject to electronic monitoring. The end of privacy, the level of labelling of people, we talked about questions of ethnicity, but the whole area of mental health is one in which labelling of people is a big issue. And then the sort of growing areas that I think the last couple of years, kind of benefits treat mentality, the labelling of people, the way in which as the those who are economically deprived in our countries have become more and more focused, and there's all the focus on benefits and reducing the welfare budget, the impact of that. These are all ways in which people are kind of, we're at risk of colluding in the systematic exclusion of people from our society by rendering them economically unable to participate. Mm. And you mentioned school exclusion as
another. Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Yes.
Huge, isn't it?
yeah, school exclusion, but do you feel it's kind of creating a...
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is that, again, historically, if you look at school exclusions, I remember in the 60s, well, I don't remember, but I do know that in the 60s that children were excluded from school under a label of special needs. And it became a very useful and much used way of excluding large swathes of children from school and therefore from education. And we find that today we are still doing the same thing. And interestingly, again, there are particular groups, working class children who are excluded in disproportionate numbers, and of course black boys excluded in disproportionate numbers. And you know, you can kind of see the links, can't you, between those school exclusions and then underemployment or unemployment, and then lifestyles, and then into the criminal justice system, and further exclusion, and on it goes.
That's right. And you mustn't be fat either.
Yeah.
Or else you may be charged for your health care or something. Mm-hmm. The range of people who are being excluded from the norm seems to be almost growing by the day.
Yeah.
Now we've got time, because Jeremy has appeared, a very welcome reappearance of his role as Old Father Time, I think, probably, to tell us that we need to finish. No, we didn't say we finished by that altitude. Early on, we were talking about migration, the issue of today, and this is an area where the dynamics of exclusion and marginalisation and the exercise of power and authority do have this focus, as we were thinking earlier, very currently. And the Immigration Act in the last government kind of extended almost sort of the borders of this country into every street kind of thing by placing a duty on landlords, on GPs to a certain extent, the rules for clergy in the Church of England, with our actually consultation and cooperation, and not with church opposition, but that does impose a duty on the clergy to check out the nationality. Well, they've always had that duty to some extent, but it's created a new structure around the
Martin, did we have that duty before? I don't think we did.
To check nationality
before marriage, because I remember when Shan started to be an issue,
yeah.
I was in the Diocese of St Albans, and we got guidance from the Chancellor about not calling bans for people.
Yeah.
They weren't European, or one of them was a European from here.
Yeah.
And I went back to the legislation and looked at it, and there was nothing in the legislation about Anglican marriage that excluded anybody on any grounds of nationality at all. And I was very uncomfortable with it, and it's changed, it's kind of caught up with what the Chancellor was telling us to do. But
yeah.
Under an ad clerum, so within the scope of our oath of canonical obedience to the bishop, we were being instructed not to marry people after bans, or not to offer them bans, to tell them that they needed to be married by licence, trusting that they wouldn't know that they could insist on bans.
Yes.
And that was gruesome from my perspective.
Indeed. Sorry, this is a bit of internal grief for the Church of England, but it is quite true. It's partly due to the fact that I think it's the European Court of Human Rights struck down the legislation and said the legislation was not fair because it discriminated. It was a different system. Yeah.
I mean, this was before even that kind of
system. So, yeah.
I'm thinking that even with this, though, you know, this idea of, as you said, you know, become the agents of the state, was the fact that even with that, even whatever the rule was, it has now been taken one step further, hasn't it? Because it's not about whether you check their nationalisation or whether their, you know, their citizenship or other, but it's about actually reporting it. And so, you know, that really is agents of the state, because of having asked that question, what do they then do? Do they then report that to immigration?
Yeah, and we haven't got time, personally, to go into the detail of that, because many hours of my life have been spent by even talking about that very issue. Lawler, we sadly talk about legal aid and the incredible shrinking of legal aid under rights of appeal in all kinds of settings. Norval, as well, we've mentioned earlier, as support for those refused asylum and so on. There's a lot of ways, a lot of fronts on which, as Christians, we need to be vigilant about the exercise of power and authority in the way in which the state seems to be accumulating to itself more and more concrete levers to exercise that power, and seeming to draw the citizenry more into the citizenry, literally, more into kind of the policing of our society. So, apologies that, again, that we have sort of ranged over a wide field, but hopefully we've given you in a rather episodic way a sort of sense of the world in which we carry on.
We have ended up bringing in this concept of sham marriage, which did not have a place in Anglican theology of marriage before.
Sham marriage has no place in Anglican theology.
It lurks around, because the immigration angle has brought in this idea of sham, that that's what clergy are supposed to be on the lookout.
In fact,
okay, so within... So there is this kind of political concept of a sham marriage, which is when it doesn't conform to kind of current definitions of what a marriage is, to do with kind of individualistic attraction and kind of, you know, maximisation of goals for the two people. But it's for immigration benefit. And therefore people are getting married so that the person, so, you know, EU citizen marries a non-EU citizen so that the non-EU citizen can get residency here and access to employment. And so within the immigration system, you have this, you know, within the tabloid newspapers, vicars conducting sham marriages, and the idea that people turn up having never met each other with a rather shiny wedding dress and a carrier bag that they pull on, they don't know the name of the person that they're married, they never see them again, there have been prosecutions of clergy who have been sort of that idea of a sham marriage doesn't exist within Anglican theology of marriage. If you go into kind of Roman Catholic understandings of marriage, you can have the idea of defective intent as grounds for annulment. So you can have the idea that they never really meant to have a proper marriage. But there's nothing quite equivalent to that within Anglican understandings of marriage. If people turn up in the church and say the words, then they are married. There's nothing kind of above and beyond to it. So it's, in one sense, it's sort of easier theologically, but it's brought in this funny idea that maybe there's an idea of a sham that's lurking there, which came out of nowhere. It wasn't something that got talked about in discussions about marriage and the theology of marriage.
There's no concept of shared marriage. The government wanted initially, when this bill was being prepared, to have shamness as an impediment, as a legal impediment to marriage. And we jokingly said, no, we can't do that, because that would be changing our theology of marriage, precisely as you say. Therefore, there's nothing in the clauses relating to church, marriage and Church of England that relates to shamness, and nothing in the practice that follows on from the legislation, because what the incumbent is obliged to do is to report to the superintendent registrar for their area, that if they've got any concerns or anxieties, and
concerns or anxieties about what?
No, I'm wrong. That was the previous thing. My son is very nice family from Texas in December, and they've had to go through all this under the new system. So I'm trying not to admit I was involved in the new system. there is simply an obligation, to report where there is a non-EEA partner. And so then it's for the Home Office to take it from there and to take any kind of action. The Home Office can't stop the marriage. There's a 28-day period, which is extended to 70 days, during which the Home Office can do what it wants, i.e. remove the person or detain them if they don't want the marriage to go ahead. But the Home Office can't tell the church, no, you can't marry this person. If the two people then turn up after 70 days, then they'll get married.
It is why it's so important that there is the kind of the integration of the policy and methodology that you will do, because you will get this kind of push from government to bring in sham, and you will get it lurking around in the debate. And there needs to be a way of kind of seeing what the real issues are, what needs pushing back against, what doesn't, and what the implications are.
I think you return to the term minority ethnic because you've really well troubled the term for us, rightly so. But I wonder what you might suggest as a way to use a different... I mean, the types of terms we might use differently. You've suggested ways of reversing the term using terms like non-black. But minority ethnic seems to stick in a public discourse. What can even the committee that you referenced, what would you suggest as an alternate? What might we do to...
As an alternate, I'd like to see no labelling. Obviously that's the ultimate, isn't it? Because of all of that I've said about othering and making those distinctions, there isn't a label that is universally acceptable. And you quite rightly pointed out our very committee. And just so that you understand that, the committee was not called the Committee for Minority Ethnic Anglican Concerns. Originally it was called the Committee for Black Anglican Concerns. But my understanding is that some years after having had that title for the committee, that there was disquiet among certain groups within the church around that label, black. And it came from what I understand from groups who felt who we label as minority ethnic, who said black doesn't fit me. I don't see myself as black. Now that brings us into this whole discussion, which again we don't have time for, around the whole labelling of black. I mean, black, white, but. You should know, and some of you you may know this, that the term black was never intended to reflect a colour in relation to black people. It was adopted as a freedom, in a sense, of that labelling. And it was self-definition, and continues to be self-definition, and it came about during the civil rights movement, in that civil rights campaigners and activists wanted to have a label, if that was necessary, that described an experience. And so therefore, actually the women's movement also used it too, as did many other movements, as did many other movements around the gay movement. So it became known as the black experience, and what that depicted was an experience of exclusion, experience of discrimination, experience of othering. And that's what black meant. It seems to have, over time, been accepted as we're talking about the colour of a person black, the colour of a person white. That was never the intention of it. So the truth is, I can't particularly answer and say, yes, use this, and that's acceptable, because labelling isn't acceptable.
That seems to be the problem with getting away from labels, for instance, in the hashtag Black Lives Matter campaign.
Yeah.
To go to All Lives Matter, obviously, is a way to try to get beyond label. But then, of course, as you point out, black is very important.
And it excludes that experience,
right,
doesn't it? You're absolutely right. I think that, you know, if I'm talking about my personal preference, is black, and I describe myself as a black woman. I'm very proud of that, and that's because that's my self-definition. So the alternative would be self-definition. That's what it would be. And again, a final story, I suppose, a very interesting story. I was working in South Africa, and at the start of the work that we were doing introductions and describing ourselves, and I described myself as a black woman, and a person in the group who clearly was horrified, felt the need to stop me immediately and soothe me, because I needed comforting and soothing, because I didn't need to call myself black, because I want, but you're not black, Elizabeth. You can call yourself coloured. You're in South Africa. and she thought she was soothing me. She thought she was comforting me. And you know that. But what it really showed me is how deep that the psyche is around all of this. That actually, for her, she was quite horrified that I would use that type of black. Because, of course, remembering her experience, you know, being black was not the thing that anybody in South Africa wanted to be. That could not be. You know, that could use something else. So.
I think we have time for one more question.
So we've got this problem with that you were talking about sham marriages in terms of ministers making too much of their role as an agent of the state.
Being required to.
Well, so I guess the imagined antagonist of that in the tabloid paper would be someone who's kind of perpetrating. I was just wondering, with lots of other problems regarding ministers as agents of the state, I've often wondered why not just throw it off and say I'll marry people, but you have to go down the street and get your certificate from someone else because I'm not an agent of the state. I haven't really seen that from anyone, and I've been a bit surprised that that's not been a strategy adopted by, you know, someone who might protest being an agent in some particular capacity. I just wondered if either of you could comment on why that hasn't happened.
Sure, why hasn't the church been disestablished, I guess.
It's been lovely
working with the Church in Wales on these issues, because they just don't mind, because they don't have the same kind of relationship with the state at all, and it would be quite freeing. But the kind of Elizabethan settlement which established in the Church of England in a position which has sort of endured ever since Queen Bess was on the throne, and so it's difficult to dislodge and unpick, and there hasn't been the will to do that, particularly actually among our faiths, because we think sometimes of the Faith Communities Forum, which sort of draws together people from all faiths, and there's an extraordinary the question of having a co-chair, that neither of the co-chairs would be an Anglican bishop, sort of struck, horrified most of them. There's a kind of sense of the establishment is kind of hardwired in a way which is difficult to understand. So, yes, that would make it a lot easier to cut the Gordian knot in that way, but it would also be part of a much broader canvas of the nature of British society, which has to be looked at in the round.
Perhaps if I could just note that in Australia, which of course has no established church, ministers of religion are empowered to marry couples also according to Australian law. So we have that situation as well. Mm-hmm. In contrast to the European countries, of course, where everyone has two marriages,
right,
registry office and church.
Yeah.
Indeed, my nephew got married in France, and he had a ceremony in the church, in the mosque, and at the burial.
Well, I just want to thank you once again for coming. We're going to be leading into our postgraduate session, which you're welcome to stay for. But you're equally welcome to wander off. I just wanted to thank you so much for what you presented. And in Jewish philosophy, they talk about the idea of tikkun olam, which is to mend the world. And I was just thinking about how your work was a real act of tikkun olam, which is the mending of the world and bringing the eternal hope into the practical reality. And the music that I've given is part of that. Is another tikkun olam. Hopefully flavor. But thank you
thank you very much
for your presentation. Just give another round.